thank you very much, Ricardo, and the other organizers for inviting me to speak. And thank you very much for your attention. I'm going to... This title is actually just referring to one part of the talk I'm going to give. I'm trying to get, going to try to give you an overview of five different areas of my research that are relevant to, at least I believe, to neuroaesthetics. And since I only have, actually I better keep track of time, I only have half an hour, let's see, I did finish around 22 past, I guess. I'm going to have to be very simplistic, but I hope it's enough for you to get a feel for the kind of research I'm doing, and that way you can talk to me afterwards over coffee or dinner or email me later, and we can go into more detail then. But this is just to give you a flavor of what I'm doing. So I'm going to go over these five topics in detail and try to sketch out how they're related to neuroaesthetics. The title of the talk actually concerns this third area, synthetic phenomenology. So, I'm not a neuroscientist. I am an artificial intelligence researcher, philosopher, cognitive scientist, really, by training, mainly a philosopher. So most of the work that I'm doing and I'm reporting on here is really providing a bridge from aesthetics and art to the cognitive sciences. And I think, therefore, there's a natural, once that's done, there's a natural way to tie that work into the neurosciences. But I'm thinking of neuroaesthetics as really a more general field of the kind that Ricardo sketched out at the beginning than just specifically limited to work that's in, directly connected with neuroscience. But it can be any kind of scientific understanding of the mind being applied to art or vice versa. So with respect to this workshop, really I'm wondering how can the models that I'm going to talk about in the next few minutes, how can they be informed by more neuroscientific detail or more or better knowledge of art and aesthetics, and vice versa? Can they actually help, say, suggest research directions for neuroscience or suggest directions in aesthetics or art? Let's take embodied creativity first. This my task has been made easier here by Professor Parisi's talk because the perspective I'm taking in this aspect of my research is very similar to what Professor Parisi is doing. And so I can just say that I also am interested in getting robots to exhibit aesthetically creative behavior. So it has to be novel in some sense, at least for the robot, and of aesthetic value for the robot and, if possible, for humans. And the idea is to take an engineering approach where you don't directly model human creativity. You don't directly model, say, what we know about the neuroscience of human creativity, but rather trying to... you only use knowledge of creativity in humans when it's expedient to getting the engineering work done. So it's allowing for the possibility that we might get insights into what counts as aesthetic or artistic creativity, even if it's being done in a very different way than how it's realized in the human brain. And that's really a general point about the artificial intelligence approach. The idea is that if you synthesize a novel instance of something, even if it's being done in a very different way than the natural instances. Nevertheless, because it's another instance of the same thing, we can see general, we can draw general conclusions. So the way that we achieved artificial flight wasn't by imitating birds. People who tried to imitate bird flight failed. It was only by abstracting out the general principles of artificial flight by creating, say, an artificial airfoil that didn't flap, didn't have feathers, that we understood what principles were involved in aerodynamics, and then we could develop flight and control flight. Similarly, so the artificial intelligence researcher says, maybe it's going to go for artistic creativity or consciousness or intelligence, whatever. It's just by trying to synthesize the same thing in a new medium, we might acquire better high-level insights as to the nature of that medium. And I have to say, this is only a manifesto. This is only a statement of the approach that I really want to take in this area one. It isn't implemented yet. So it's just a set of I'm going to just list one more slide on this area. It's just a set of assumptions I'm making in this area that I think would be useful for understanding creating an artificially aesthetically creative agent. One simple idea is to use this notion of motivators that Professor Parisi talked about. If you have motivations built into your robot, or if you allow your robot to develop motivations such that novel inputs will be experienced as being highly pleasurable, then it will be more likely that that robot will produce what it considers novel inputs. So one way to get creativity out of your robot is to make things that are creative experienced as pleasurable for that robot, and let pleasure be the dominant principle in action selection. To be a good creator of aesthetic objects, it helps to be a good appreciator of aesthetic objects. I think a lot of work in artificial creativity has ignored this fact. They've tried to create, say, music composition programs that are supposed to generate nice musical outputs, but the program that's producing these outputs is not itself an appreciator of music. It cannot listen to music, and it has no experience of pleasure or anything like pleasure when if you were to somehow allow it to hear music. The idea here is the robot will be in the first instance, capable of perceiving the world and perceiving, let's say, in this case, sound, and derive some pleasure from some sounds, that is, seek out those sounds when possible. If it notices that when it performs a particular action, a sound that it gets pleasure from results, then it will tend to engage in that action in the future. In order to prevent things from getting boring, let me move on to the third principle. The third principle is that rather than having this be a completely virtual exercise where the things created are bits of symbolic specifications of notes and the things that are perceived by the robot are symbolic specifications of notes, why not let the robot actually make acoustic vibrations in the air in the real world and perceive those acoustic vibrations in the air, just as we do? I think this will allow for... There are all kinds of reasons I can't go into now for why this will have, I think, better results. But one I can mention is just not only will we be able to hear these sounds, but also it will be able to hear all the sounds that we're generating all the time. It will be experiencing the real world and therefore be more likely to be socialized into our real world. But also it will allow for a kind of serendipity, a kind of unplanned emergent creativity that is missing in the austere world of the symbolically specified music. Professor Parisi already mentioned point four. I really won't go over it more than that. The degree to which you better make the preferences of the robot similar to the preferences of humans, otherwise, we're unlikely to perceive ascribe much value to what the robot ascribes value to. And social aspects are important. I'll skip over that. We just heard a very good talk about that. And also, Professor Friesen mentioned it too. A big idea that I'm trying to focus on is that you can think of creative output as being the outcome of an arms race, internal arms race between two parts of a creature, two parts of the robot in this case. One part is its capacity to understand the world and make sense of it. The other part of the race, the other thing that it's competing with, is deliberately trying to outstrip that first part. That is, it's the part of the world part of the robot that wants to be surprised, that gets pleasure out of novelty. And if the robot itself is making sounds that it's also listening to, then maybe the first time it makes some sounds, it will find that novel and interesting and surprising, and therefore will get pleasure out of it. But quickly, it will habituate and lose interest in that. So the idea is to have the robot constantly increasing its abilities to detect patterns, which will make it harder and harder for it to be surprised and harder for an output that it makes to be novel, So then it will try harder to create outputs that outstrip its pattern classification abilities and so on in a mutually beneficial spiral. Dynamics should play a role, so temporal aspects of the product, of the thing that they've been saying, in this case music that the robot is making, should play a role. And the patterns in the robot's own internal states can be monitored by the robot and can be the objects of appreciation. So it might find aesthetic value in certain of sequences of its own internal states. And that could add a dimension of richness here that that just the artifacts themselves might not be able to produce. And lastly, the best way to make outputs in the real world is to be embodied in the real world, and that's why I had on the previous slide I showed these IBO robots. The idea here is that instead of just having music making by the IBO robots be sending some command to a digital sound chip that allows that makes some vibrations in the air, it might be better to actually require the robot to physically engage in some kind of joint movement or limb movement. So the idea here would be that only by, say, moving its arm in this particular way is a particular sound emitted. And so the robot will actually have to act in the world in order to create sounds that it therefore, afterwards finds pleasing or displeasing. And so it'll be more like the kinds of physical creativity that humans have. Action in the real world will be required. Okay, so that's one of the areas that I'm interested in, and I can't spend any more time on it, really. I just have a few slides here just to say that the underlying architecture is roughly neurally inspired in a very similar form of what we've seen before, which is a simple recurrent network. But it is, the idea there is that on a very superficial level, we have some kind of neural computation going on, and maybe more realistic models of neural computation would allow for a better connection between neuroaesthetics in the narrow sense and neuroaesthetics in the wider context that I'm talking about. Area two is, I call, enacted models of experience. I've been investigating how one might explain, in particular, visual phenomenology, that is, visual, the content of visual experience, by understanding it as being the outcome of a set of expectations that we have of how the visual input we receive would change if we were to perform different actions. So the reason why I'm experiencing the scene right now is not necessarily because, let's think about the blue that I'm experiencing over from this part of the room, which has to do with the tablecloth over there. Now, according to my account here, the reason why I have an aspect of blue phenomenology there is not because I'm receiving blue wavelength light on my retina right now, because actually we know that color receptors are actually only most densely congregated in a particular... You only really are getting color input right now from a very small region of your retina, and that's not in it. So why is it that I'm experiencing blue in that region right now? Well, it's because I have an expectation that were I to look over there and get light falling on that proper part of my the fovea where there are dense collections of color receptors, I have an expectation that I would get a certain kind of input, the input characteristic of blue-colored things in this light. So the theory that I'm looking at here is basically saying that most of, say, your visual experience is not a fact function of the light hitting your eyes right now. It's a function of the expectations of what kind of light you would receive were you to move this way and that, move your eyes over there, move your head over there. And, of course, that's the result of the light hitting your eyes in the past when you did look over there before. But right now, it's actually constituted by your expectations of sensory input, not the sensory input you're receiving at this moment. So, the idea is, I can't go into why that actually turns out to be a good model of a lot of visual phenomenology, but it can account for a lot of aspects of visual phenomenology that are thought to be problematic for certain kinds of, well, we call them representational accounts. But really, if you use this kind of model, you can give plausible accounts of these kinds of aspects of visual phenomenology. So the idea with respect to neuroaesthetics is to generalize this expectation-based model of visual experience to see if you can create an expectation-based model of aesthetic experience. So the idea is maybe we could use two extensions. Now, I realize I'm asking a lot of you as an audience member right now, because normally I would spend an hour explaining the theory of expectation-based theory of visual experience, and I'm expecting you to already understand that now, and then understand how it can be modified to account for aesthetic experience. So I realize you're not going to necessarily understand everything that I'm talking about here, but I just hope you can get a feel for the kind of work I'm doing, and then we can talk about it later, or I can recommend various papers. But the idea here is that if we want to extend it from mere visual phenomenology to aesthetic experience, then maybe we can do that by adding affect. We've already seen several people stress the affective, essentially affective nature of art and aesthetic experience. And also something that is characteristically aesthetic, I don't have a better term for this, that has to do with experiencing a work of art as a work of art, as an artifact that was created by someone using some particular process. Now, the first part isn't so hard. I've already actually been doing some work in this regard. Just as a system can have expectations concerning what visual input it will receive if it were to, say, look this way or that way, so also a system can have expectations about whether a pleasurable or unpleasurable state will result from various actions. Like if I were to slam my hand down on the desk, that will result in an unpleasurable state for me. So right now, part of my experience is of a thing in front of me that were I to do this, it would be unpleasurable for me. So that's part of my experience right now. It's an affective component. I'm not feeling pain right now. But the fact that I would feel pain were I to do that is part of my experience right now. Or at least it is when I focus on this particular region and these particular actions. So we could incorporate affect in a similar way as we have an account of visual phenomenology. We have this kind of affective phenomenology about all the possible ways I might get rewarded or have experienced pain where I could engage in a lot of different actions. But there's also this artificial, in the sense of artifice, or this aesthetic component. When we experience a visual, say, visual work of art, we do not just experience its visual properties, which I've already talked about. I've talked about an account of the visual properties of the work of art. It's just the expected visual input as we move our eyes over the canvas. But in addition to that, we experience it as a work of art in that we have expectations for how the work would change if we were to make this or that brushstroke, or if the artist had made this or that brushstroke. So there's this essential, at least for a certain kind of aesthetic experience, you perceive it as something that is the result of having been made in a particular way. And it might not, your idea of how that's done might not be very sophisticated, but you are at least thinking of it as the kind of object that was produced in that way and has its properties by virtue of having certain actions being taken onto it. So if this is a kind of sketch in itself of how we might extend the expectation-based architecture to involve, to get away from just thinking of visual works of art as mere visual input, but also as the result of some kind of artistic intervention and experiencing them in that way. So that's all I'm going to say about that. Section 3, the one that the title of my talk most directly concerns, I call this aspect of my work synthetic phenomenology. This is maybe the best example of how what I'm talking about today is not the case of neuroscience helping us understand art or aesthetics better, but it's how art or aesthetics might help us do neuroscience better. So the point that I want to emphasize is that if you're trying to have a science of consciousness, a science of experience, you better have some way of precisely talking about the experiences that you're trying to explain, or using your explanations. We use experiences sometimes to explain each other's behavior. So if you want to use particular experiences to explain why someone gets up and leaves a room, or if you want to explain experiences themselves, then you better have a precise way of specifying the experiences, specify the character of the experiences. I refer to the character as the content of the experiences. So a standard means would be, trying to do that would be to say, the subject is having a visual experience of a red bike leaning against a white fence. Okay, so we'd use English or our language of choice in order to try to specify the content of the experience. But that's notoriously imprecise and inexact. Clearly, our visual experiences are in many ways not captured by that. I mean, for one thing, they seem to be very richly detailed. Another way is just a kind of indeterminacy of our visual perceptions that it's hard to capture in English statements like that. So there are all kinds of reasons why this is just not very good for scientific purposes. And so it can only specify maybe a subset of our experiences, if at all. It's not going to be very useful for a lot of our visual phenomenology. So one idea, and I won't be able to go through these slides in detail, given the time restrictions, but one idea is just to use something other than language to try and specify the content of experiences to be explained or later using in an explanation. And one obvious idea is to use non-symbolic representations. For instance, pictures might be one way. It's to use pictures as a way of doing that. But there's a reason why you can't just, for reasons I can't go into, you can't just, if you want to capture the visual content of the scene the subject is seeing, you can't just take a photograph of that scene. That's too objective. It doesn't reflect the subjectivity of the person viewing the scene and their what they're not attending to, what their interests are. It's better than maybe a linguistic specification in some ways, but it still isn't quite right. So the idea of this synthetic phenomenology part of my research is to come up with depictions of specifications of experience by generating depictions through building robotic models of experience and then using the states of the robotic model to generate diagrams that will give the viewers of the diagrams some idea of the experiential state the robot is modeling. I can't go over all the details here, but roughly, I'm going to show you a picture. Actually, it's a movie, and that movie is meant to give you some idea of the set of... Remember, I'm taking this expectation-based approach to visual phenomenology, so this diagram is meant to give you an idea of what expectations the robot has for what input it will get if it moves its eye in various ways. So I think I can...
show you an example of one of these depictions. Third time is a charm. There we go. So
this is meant to the robotic model of visual experience. The robotic model of visual experience that I have that I use to generate this is moving its camera around in the world. And it's getting information about what is there in the world, and therefore it's generating expectations about what it will see if it moves its camera back to that part of the world. And since things change, the expectations fade over time. So that means that it's less and less certain about what information and what input it will receive if it moves its camera there as time passes. So here's an example of a way of trying to convey from one theorist to another the content of the experiential state without using a language. I don't just say, well, it's having an experience of a person wearing a green shirt. Because that isn't quite really what the experiential state is. It's more properly specified with this depicted diagram. Okay, let's go beyond this. There we go. Okay. So what's the connection to aesthetics, to art? Well, in a sense, this task of content specification that I'm concerned with, that's what at least some artists have been trying to do for millennia. They've been trying to specify, trying to communicate from one person to another an experience. Not all art, but some of it. And thus, I think there's a clear role here for artists, for graphic designers, for sound engineers, for directors, for people who have rather skill at creating in the audience, let's say, in the audience, a particular experience. These are people who have a skill at knowing what needs to be put on the screen in order for the audience to have a particular kind of experience. So they can assist the scientific task of coming up with specifications that will be much better than what I just gave you. What I just gave you just gave you some idea about the expectational state of that robot. But maybe a graphic designer or an artist could say, oh, no, we know how to do this. Here, this is a much better way. Use this color scheme. Use this timing rate. Use this to indicate fading. Don't use that. So there'll be all kinds of ways that artists will... My point here is that the visualization here isn't just a superficial add-on to the science. It's essential to the science in this case because the point is to specify the experience precisely, and we won't have done that unless we have the right visualization tools or oralization tools in the case of sound. So, so here's an example. So I'm just going to try to skip through this. So this isn't. So some people might be worried and say, "Well, if you're bringing art into it and artistic skill, things like cinematographic techniques, then aren't we losing the objectivity of science? Isn't this now becoming too subjective? Science is striving to be objective, but art, artistic techniques are so subjective. So is that a problem? Well, perhaps, but." The reason, when art works, it's for an objective reason. So there's a reason why we understand the neuroscience of, say, persistence of vision. We know why. We know the conditions that have to obtain for you to experience the illusion of motion. We know how many frames per second. That's an example of how we can use science to investigate the techniques that artists have been using for a much longer length of time. But artists need to suggest those techniques to us. And then we can have a unified scientific and artistic approach that will allow us to do so in an objective way. And this makes the theorist who's using this content specification techniques almost, it's making them a part of the inquiry, actually, because you have to understand the psychology of and perceptual capacities of the theorist. How much time do I have left?
It's
2 minutes. 5 minutes, okay. I'll wind things up very quickly with the last two sections. So I'm not really worried about the subjectivity of art. In fact, I think science does strive to be objective, but the objectivity of science is not the elimination of the scientist's subjectivity. It's the negotiation or exploitation of the scientist's subjectivity. So using the scientist's subjectivity in the right way, that's what an objective science of consciousness. As I said, I think we have a two-way interaction here. It's not just that we're doing a neuroscience of art or a neuroscience of aesthetics. We're also trying to see how artistic insights and techniques and methodologies can help us in doing a science of the mind. The fourth area, and these last two are very quick, one slide for the fourth area. I call this aspect of my research interactive empiricism. Don't really have time to explain the term, but I think that a lot of roadblocks in our understanding of the mind, in particular our understanding of consciousness, are philosophical roadblocks. They're conceptual roadblocks. And therefore, we need conceptual breakthroughs. We need conceptual progress. And I think it's the case that not all of those conceptual breakthroughs can be achieved by reason alone. Can't just sit in your armchair as a philosopher and achieve these philosophical breakthroughs. It's still philosophy that needs to be done, But the breakthroughs that are needed cannot be require new concepts, not just recombinations of concepts that are already possessed. And I think that it's a fact about our cognitive makeup and the cognitive makeup of philosophers that in order for them to get these new concepts, they actually have to do something. In order to acquire sufficiently radically new concepts of something, you need to engage in experiential activity. So to quote something that Eric Snowden and I wrote a few years ago, modeling of consciousness requires some clarifications and refinements of our concept of consciousness. Design of, instruction of, and interaction with artificial systems can itself assist in this conceptual development. And I think not just building artificial systems like robots, but also sensory augmentation devices. So some work I've done with Tom Frieza and Adam Spears using sensory augmentation devices that I don't have time to explain. We've been doing studies to see how using this device has actually changed people's concepts of perception. And in particular, and most relevant to today, artworks are, in this sense, artificial systems. Creation of them and interaction with them might be crucial to coming up with the new concepts of aesthetic experience that we require, and maybe of experience in general, that we require in order to make progress on some of the conceptual roadblocks that we've encountered. And so finally, we get to work that I've been doing, which is actually producing, in a very modest way, some aesthetic objects that have been exhibited in a couple of places. Oh, actually, we're missing one. Right. So, oh well, that's not the one I thought you were going to see. Oh, there we go. So, we've created some aesthetic objects as well. So, my interest in neuroaesthetics, the connection between a scientific understanding of the mind and art, is not just the theoretical one in terms of explanations, vice in each way, but actually using some of the data structures that we generate by having our robots interact with the real world, using them in a way that creates, well, turning them into aesthetic objects for their own sake. So we've had we've had installations at a couple of places, including the Shrewsbury Open. And here's just an example of one work that is generated by post-processing some of the depictions, like the one you saw earlier, in a particular way. And that's how I will, if I can get past this slide. Oh, right, I have a recap. So just the final slide. I'm interested in embodied artistic creativity. I am interested in inactive models of aesthetic experience. I'm interested in specifying the content of the sensory, affective, and, for want of a better word, aesthetic components of experiencing artworks, and understanding how, say, robots can help us do that. I'm interested in interactive empiricism, that is, changing our concepts of experience through creating or interacting with systems like artworks, and I'm interested in creating artworks and installations themselves. And I think I can just leave you with this running in the background. Thank you.